Good morrow!
I'm Beverly.
I'm Allison.
Welcome back to Shaky Understanding.
This week, we are talking about Henry V. Henry the Fifth.
The conclusion of the Henriad Quadrilogy.
Whew, man, it's been a long journey, and it's even longer, so stick with me while I go through some Shakespeare Abridged. We open the show with the chorus, who appears and says, "We're about to watch a story that will include huge fields, grand battles, and fighting kings. However, we will have to use our imaginations to make this story come to life because they only have a small wooden stage, not fields of France, and there's only a few actors who are going to appear on stage, and we should imagine that they're huge armies fighting to the death." So the chorus says, "Use your imagination. Let's do it." We then see the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of Ely, who are two powerful English churchmen. They're conferring with one another, talking about a bill that's been brought up for consideration. The bill that Henry V now is considering is a bill that will pass into law and authorize the government to take away a great deal of the church's land and money, and that money would be then used to maintain the army, support the poor, and supplement the king's treasury. And the clergymen obviously want to just keep this money for themselves. Now, Henry's also been thinking about invading France, but now that he's a little older, wiser, and king, Henry's going to meet with a delegation of French ambassadors who come over to England, so Ely and Canterbury head for the throne room to participate in the meeting. In the throne room, King Henry's kind of preparing to speak with these ambassadors, and he has several of advisors with him. His two younger brothers are there as well. And King Henry asks Canterbury to explain to him the reasons why he, as King of England, has rightful claim to the throne of France. So Canterbury gives the nobleman in the throne room a long explanation of why Henry does, in fact, have a valid claim to the throne of France. Hold on to your butts. In France, the throne cannot be inherited through a mother. That is, if the king has a daughter, the daughter's son has no claim to the throne. But England has no such law. This is known as Salic law in France. So kings can inherit the throne through the female line. Because King Henry's great-great-grandmother was a daughter of the King of France, under English law, he would be the rightful heir to the throne of France. Of course, the French obviously do not think the same way, and they believe that their King Charles the Sixth is the rightful monarch. So if Henry wants to have the throne of France, he needs to go play Game of Thrones and fight for it himself. Both of the clergymen are urging Henry to invade, as do his advisors, Exeter and Westmoreland, and Henry's kind of resolved to proceed with the invasion. But he calls in the ambassadors just to see what they have to say, and what they have to say is not good. Their message is super insulting. The ambassador laughs at Henry's claim to any part of France and says that Henry is still too young to be responsible. So he gives him a gift from the King of France, a container of tennis balls, which is mocking Henry's youth and his sport attitude. Did not get that. One of my first questions was, why tennis balls? So that's the symbolism, guys. Symbolism 101. Now the chorus comes in. And introduces the second act, telling us that all of England is fired up and arming for the war. King Henry is almost ready to invade France, but French agents have sent some corrupt noblemen within the English ranks, and they bribed them into acting as secret double agents. These noblemen are Richard, Earl of Cambridge, Henry, Lord Scrope of Masham, and Sir Thomas Grey of Northumberland. You can only say those names in a British accent, let's be real. This trio has agreed to kill King Henry in Southampton just before he sets sail for France. Now we go to our next scene, ooh la la, to London near a tavern in Eastcheap, which is a very seedy part of town. Bardolph and Nim appear. They're now lieutenant and corporal, respectively. They're preparing to head off to war, and both of the men are commoners. Bardolph was once a criminal. Nim has a quarrel with a fellow soldier. Pistols now married Mistress Quickly, who you might remember from a previous episode, the hostess of the Boar's Head Tavern in London. Mistress Quickly had previously promised to marry Nim, so Pistol and Nim draw their swords to attack each other, and they must be quieted several times by the hostess and by Bardolph. Then a boy appears, a page of a knight named Sir John Falstaff comes in. Falstaff's a close friend of everyone present. You might remember he's a very beloved character, but he's now very old and very sick in bed, and the boy reports that he's getting worse. So the hostess goes to check on him and comes back and says, yeah, he's dying for sure. So the men put aside their quarrel to go visit him. Nim and Pistol speak darkly of something that King Henry has done to Falstaff. And apparently it is some way the king's fault that Falstaff is on his deathbed. We go back over to the port of Southampton. King Henry's preparing to set sail for France, and there's a conversation between Gloucester, Exeter, and Westmoreland revealing that Henry has already discovered the treachery of Cambridge, Scrope, and Grey, the traitors that the French kind of paid off, but the traitors don't know yet. So Henry enters with this same group of men that are planning to kill him. They're talking about some local problems. He's getting their advice on if he should forgive someone or not forgive someone. And then he lets it slide. Hey, guys, I know that you're going to betray me. And here's the proof. He hands them some evidence that he's got on paper. And the three lords or noblemen beg for mercy. But Henry says, no, you sold my life for money. You don't want me to give mercy to anyone. And I'm definitely not giving it to you. So he orders the trio to be executed. And then he says, the discovery of these traitors and the facts that I can execute them so easily means that God is on the side of the English. Let's go to France. Now we go back to the tavern to learn that Falstaff is dead, and Pistol, Bardolph, Nim, etc., they prepare to leave for war with the little messenger boy. So we scoot on over to France, where we see King Charles and his nobles and his son discuss the approach of King Henry's English forces. Now King Charles's eldest son, who is the Dauphin, believes that Henry is foolish and young and immature and definitely not going to win this war. Dauphin is very eager to fight, but Charles says, I don't know. These ambassadors came back from England, and there's the army's looking pretty good. Coffers are pretty full. This might not go our way. So Charles reminds his son that Henry's forebears have been fierce and victorious fighters against the French, especially Henry's great-grandfather, Edward III of England, and his son, Edward, Black Prince of Wales. And then the English nobleman, Exeter, arrives over in France, bringing a message from King Henry. Henry's already landed in France, and he formally demands that King Charles yield up the crown and all the honors and land that go with it. If Charles refuses, Henry promises to invade France and take it by force. Exeter tells Charles to consider carefully and to return an answer quickly. Charles says that he'll send a message back in the morning. He's got to think about it. So the chorus then comes back in to describe the magnificence with which King Henry sails from England to France. We learn that Henry has a large fleet of warships at Harfleur, a port city on the northern coast of France. And the English army attacks the city with terrifying force, so the alarmed king says, hey, Henry, here, how about this for a compromise? I'm not going to give you the crown of France, but I'll give you a couple of dukedoms, and you can marry my daughter. And Henry goes, no, I'm taking it all. So in the midst of the siege, King Henry appears to rally his soldiers. He delivers a powerful speech, conjuring up the memory of the Englishmen's warlike ancestors and appealing to soldiers, noblemen, and commoners alike. But when we see Nim, Bardolph, Pistol, and the boy, they reveal that the reception of the king's speech is kind of mixed. He was good. Wasn't great. Bardolph appears very eager to fight, but Nim and Pistol and the boy are less happy about the idea of facing death. So they just want to be in London getting shit-faced. Then a superior officer notices these men just loitering around, and he beats them with a sword until they rush back into the fight. This is the Welsh captain, Fluellen. The grown men run off, but the boy remains behind for a few moments, this little page boy, and he muses on the hypocrisy of Nim, Bardolph, and Pistol. He declares that they're all cowards. He's learned this much in the time he's been serving them. He says that they want him to start learning to pick pockets and become a thief like them, but that such an idea is an affront to his manhood. He decides he needs to leave them and look for a better job. This is my favorite moment in the entire play and probably in the whole collection of history plays. When the little boy has his soliloquy and it's like, I don't want to be a thief. I need to find better friends. It's so great. On so many, I just love it on so many levels. It's adorable.
That's great.
Then, hang in there, guys. We're getting there, I promise. There's a flourish of trumpets, and King Henry appears before the gates of the French town of Harfleur, and the town says, whoa, let's negotiate for a sec, don't invade us. And the governor stands on the town walls, and Henry addresses him saying, you should surrender now. And if you surrender, the people in the town are going to be allowed to live. But if you make it so that the English have to fight our way inside your town, we're going to destroy the town, rape, pillage, kill all the kids. You know, and the governor says, I don't really want to surrender because I've just received word from the Dauphin that no army can be raised to rescue us. So, guess I'm going to surrender because I don't want to die. So he opens the town gates and Henry orders Exeter to fortify Harfleur as a citadel from which the English can fight the French. And he says that he will take the forces onward to Calais the next day. Then we have an amazing interlude scene between Catherine, Princess of France, and her maid Alice, and their scene is totally in French. So, there you go.
Do you not know what happens?
I do know what happens, kind of, but I just want to leave it like that because I think it's so funny that you're just reading this play and then it's all in French.
In my copy, the whole notes just have the entire translation.
The English translation?
I'm just going to give the gist. The gist was she's talking to her maid and being like, quick, I need to learn English because I might have to marry an English king. Like,
Okay. Teach
me the word for this. That's why some of it's in English. You see
right.
her say, like, those
yeah.
words.
Right.
She's saying, like, really? They say it like that? And then, like, one of the ways she pronounces one of the words sounds like a dirty word. So she's like, English are so, base. Ugh.
Right. Gotcha.
That's the thing.
Elsewhere at the French court, King Charles and his son and advisors have an urgent meeting to discuss King Henry's swift advance through France. King Charles, who is a little smarter, more decisive than his advisors, orders all the noblemen to raise troops for the army. Charles and his men are very confident that with this great number of troops raised, they can intimidate King Henry, conquer his army, and bring him back as a defeated prisoner. Now, after the English take Harfleur, the Welsh captain, Llewellyn, talks with the English captain, Gower, about the battle for a bridge that's currently taking place, and Pistol enters with a favor to beg of Llewellyn. Pistol's good friend, Bardolph, has been found guilty of stealing from the conquered French town, and he's been sentenced to death by hanging. And Pistol begs Llewellyn to intercede with the Duke of Exeter to save Bardolph's life, but Llewellyn politely refuses, saying, you know, discipline's got to be maintained. So Pistol curses Llewellyn, gives him the finger, and stalks away. It says an obscene
Spanish,
gesture.
Spanish fig.
All the things.
The fig. He gives
Spanish,
him the fig.
The Spanish fig.
There you go. With a drum roll, King Henry enters, and he questions Llewellyn about the battle for the bridge and how many soldiers the English side lost. Llewellyn answers that, you know, we've had some pretty smart fighting from Duke of Exeter, so we've won the bridge, and no English soldiers have been lost except Bardolph, who we had to kind of nix for stealing. And King Henry says, okay, good, good. Even though he and Bardolph were friends a while ago, he's like, cool, cool, you do what you gotta do. Then Montjoy, a French messenger, arrives with a very menacing message from the King of France, who declares that the time has come for him to punish the overly proud King Henry. And he suggests that Henry start thinking about his ransom, because they're gonna kidnap him. King Henry sends back just a really chill reply. He says, you know, my army's tired, I don't really want to fight you guys, but I'm gonna continue to do it, because I think I'm right, and I think I'm gonna win, so bye! The chorus describes the scene in the French and English camps the night before the battle. It's quiet night, burning watchfires, the clank of knights being suited up in their armor. The English camp in Agincourt, King Henry talks briefly with his brothers, Gloucester and Clarence, and Sir Thomas Erpingham, and he asks to borrow Erpingham's dirty cloak. And then he sends off all his people. He just wants to hang around in his borrowed cloak and just be anonymous for a little bit. So he sits by the campfire, just chatting with whoever comes by. He just wants to be an ordinary soldier. So he talks to Pistol for a little bit. Henry brings up the subject of the king, and Pistol praises Henry in kind of a roundabout, rough way. Then Llewellyn and Gower come by, but they don't even notice him. They're too busy talking to each other. Then three common soldiers, John Bates, Alexander Court, and Michael Williams, join Henry at the campfire. And Henry discusses with them the English troops' odds in the coming battle and finds that they doubt the motives and the courage of the king, because of course they don't recognize him in his anonymous cloak. And Henry defends the absent king, but Williams will not back down, so they establish a quarrel. What they do is they exchange gloves, signaling their intent to fight each other later if they both survive the battle. So then the three soldiers leave, and Henry just muses to himself. He laments the lonely isolation of power. And the only consolation Henry can see in being king is the elaborate ceremony and costuming that accompanies the position. But really, he just would rather be a slave who is at least able to rest easy and not worry about the safety of his country. So, almost time for the battle, Henry prays to God to strengthen the hearts of his soldiers. Then, at their camp, we see the French prepare for battle, and the constable, Lord Rambers, the Earl of Grandpere, and others put on their armor and mount their horses, and they give pre-battle speeches full of confidence and cheerfulness, and they see that the English army is really small, and the French go, ha ha, we're going to win, easy peasy. The English noblemen realize that the French outnumber them 5-1, and Westmoreland wishes that they had some of the men who sit idle in England. But King Henry enters and overhears them, and he disagrees. He gives a very famous speech, St. Crispin's Day speech, because he gave it on October 25th, St. Crispin's Day. And he says, we should be happy that there are so few of us present, for each of us have a greater share of the honor. Then the battle commences, and it rages across the field. Pistol takes a French prisoner. Pistol can't speak French and is trying to communicate with his prisoner who doesn't speak English. The boy is present, the little page, and he speaks very good French. He's able to translate, but hot-headed Pistol makes communication very difficult. And this poor French soldier is convinced that Pistol's a nobleman and a ferocious fighter. The French soldier gives his name as Monsieur Lefebvre, says that he's from a respected house and family and that his relatives will give Pistol a rich ransom if Pistol will let him live. Pistol, of course, is very interested in money and accepts this payment, and the Frenchman surrenders as a willing captive. As the boy follows them off stage, he complains about Pistol's empty boasting, saying that Bardolf and Nym had 10 times as much real courage as Pistol. And then the boy reveals a surprising fact. Nym has been hanged for stealing like Bardolf. Yeah, this boy is right. He needs to get out of their company.
I know, dude.
He needs to get off the streets. On the field of the battle, the English appear to have seized the advantage and have captured a bunch of French soldiers and noblemen, but the battle's not quite over as a bunch of the French continue to fight. Exeter gives King Henry an update on the battle. The English are doing well, but the Duke of York and the Earl of Suffolk have been killed, and everyone's very upset. And then there's a big stir and a big cry, and King Henry interprets the commotion as a rally by the French, and so he orders every English soldier to kill his French prisoners, which is a remarkably bloody move and not really a little bit against the Geneva Convention of the time, the codes of chivalrous battle. Now, back in the battle, Llewellyn talks with Gower. There's a small group of French soldiers that have been fleeing the main crush of the battle, and they've attacked the English camp, and they've done something even worse. They've murdered all of the young pages, mere children, like the little boy that we've been seeing, who are left in the camp. And Llewellyn is outraged at the French atrocity of killing the young pages, which also violates the chivalrous codes of battle. So he agrees with Gower in saying, you know what, Henry was right. We should have slaughtered all the French prisoners like we did. That was a good choice. Henry is as good as Alexander the Great. Then King Henry appears with the Duke of Bourbon as a prisoner. Having learned about the slaughter of these young boys, he says that he's angrier than he has ever been, and he repeats the order to kill the French prisoners. Montjoy, the messenger who we saw earlier, reappears, and he brings a request from the King of France that the French be allowed to go safely into the battlefield to identify, recover, and bury their dead. King Henry demands to know whether the English have won. Montjoy says, yeah, you guys won, okay? Like, it's fine. Can we just go bury them, please? Then Henry spots the soldier Michael Williams, with whom he argued and exchanged gloves and set up a duel the night before. So Henry decides to play a practical joke. He gives Williams gloves to Llewellyn and tells him to wear it publicly, saying that it came from a noble Frenchman in the field and that anyone who attacks Llewellyn over it must be a traitor to the English. So Henry then follows to see the fun of this practical joke, which is probably going to get Michael Williams killed. Burn. That's hilarious, King Henry. So funny. Talk about dark humor. The chorus then orders the audience to return its imagination to France with the understanding that some time has passed. At the palace of the King of France, King Henry's come to meet with Charles and his Queen Isabel. The goal of the meeting is to negotiate a lasting peace between France and England. Ha ha ha. Despite his military victory, King Henry says, you know what, Charles, I'm going to allow you to retain the throne, but I have a long list of demands. The first of which is that I get to marry your daughter, my distant cousin, Princess Catherine of France, because that's Gucci. Then Henry and his heirs will inherit France as well as England. So his progeny are going to be heir to two thrones. The others in this meeting discreetly retire from the room, leaving Henry and Catherine alone, but they have Catherine's maid Alice to help translate, because again, one speaking English, one speaking French. It's a pretty funny scene. Henry's trying to court Catherine and she's kind of getting it, but not really. Catherine does eventually agree to marry Henry, but says, you know, it's really up to my dad, so you gotta check in with him. The chorus then appears for the last time to deliver the epilogue. It's a pretty quick little speech and mentions that Catherine and Henry are supposedly happily married, as I guess we could say, and they do have a son, King Henry VI of England, who went on to lose France and bring England into war. And then with a final plea for the audience's tolerance of the play, the chorus brings it all to a close.
That was a doozy. So we have a guest today.
We do indeed. Welcome, welcome.
Well, this here is Ensign Pistol.
That's right. Why, hello there and good morrow, whatever.
Welcome, welcome. So you're
thank you,
Ensign Pistol?
Ancient.
Oh, ancient Pistol.
But
ancient
don't let the
pistol.
Name fool you. I'm young and spry.
Where does the name Ancient Pistol come from?
It actually means
title.
Handsome, charming,
that's not
extremely
true.
Chivalrous man of the army, leader of men, all crammed into one.
He's right.
Oh, wow.
Or I am so right. You just don't know the obscurity of my knowledge.
I'm only blushing from the hot coffee.
Of course.
Drinking.
I can tell.
Ooh.
Yeah. It's a title of the army.
Yes.
In for realsies.
In for realsies. It means lower ensign.
Lower ensign?
That's
like
right.
You're not quite ensign?
Almost ensign.
It's
but
like
listen,
private? Is it like private?
I could say it's a little private, but you keep asking. But the other matter being is, I would say ensign, actual ensign, not so great. You want to be an ancient. There's a lot more respect there. Who does the work? The ancient. Who keeps claiming the work? The ensign. Forget about it.
It's like a barback.
A noble barback.
Pistol, I've got a question for you. Or should I call you Ancient?
No, call me Pistol. That's my name.
All right.
I shoot from the hip.
So, the tennis balls now
tennis
make
ball.
Sense to me.
Good.
But I'm curious, do you play tennis, and what were the tennis balls
if
made of?
I may say, I play the best tennis. Tennis. I would say I was raised on tennis, but you wouldn't know that I was from the way that I play. I give myself a mental handicap whenever playing. That's right. I play worse, yes, to help my opponents. I'm so good. Now, the tennis balls themselves, well, I don't have enough time to examine them because I'm hitting them so hard across the court. Just the ferocity of my game is, it's like a lion.
You got mad game.
Mad game, as
I
they
understand.
Say, in the hood.
I understand.
I'm looking at
yeah,
tennis.
We're looking it up, because I'm just so curious. I knew that tennis was an ancient game, if you'll pardon the pun.
It's more of a French nobility game.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Mm-hmm. But I knew it
they
had
were made of
for
wood.
They were made of wood, okay.
Wrapped in leather.
Instead of using rackets, they used to use gloves.
So it was
see what I'm talking about?
It was essentially playing catch, but over a net.
That's right.
But
it's like easy catch.
But then they got brackets, and then the balls became leather.
Okay. And then you married Mistress quickly?
Love hit me hard. Struck but once.
Listen.
What?
She's one of my favorites of
she
all time. We
is
met her.
A jewel.
She's
a
fabulous.
Gem. That's right.
So you're in love.
The heart of my hearth, if we will.
The heart of your hearth?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, that's right. You have never heard that expression?
Must be old.
You're not from where I'm
must
from.
Must be ancient.
Touché. For those of you wondering, I'm drinking coffee.
Could have said bourbon.
No.
That's a French drink.
That's right. Brandy. You're thinking of brandy.
I'm sorry. Sack is not brandy. Sack is wine.
Sack could be the brandy, baby.
Oh, shit.
I tried a beer last night, and I had two sips.
Did you like one of those sips.
I like the first sip.
The second sip, so I hate it. You know, there's a cure for that. It's called the third sip. It only gets better.
Don't play with your heart. What do you mean?
I like beer now. That's what I thought was coming out of your mouth. And instead it was two sips.
No, but usually I only have one sip and I go, gross. I never absolutely want this in my mouth ever again.
If I had a nickel.
That's a good rate.
Wait, what?
I'm just saying. Look, if you need some work.
Okay. I just wanted to say I love your wife.
She's fantastic.
She's a hero of mine.
That's right. Heart of my hearth.
Yes, heart of your hearth. Heart of my hearth. Just a strong, independent woman. She takes no crap from anybody.
Not even me.
That's right.
That's why you married her.
She told me to.
I don't think anyone could tie you down.
That's right. I'm a rogue. Yeah. I don't know if you knew that. I bramble from hill to other hill. That's right. Unstoppable.
Hill to small mountain.
That's right. How did you know? You're clearly a fan. I don't blame you.
No, I just... You're hard to miss. You leave a wake of people trying to fight you.
Well, that's not my fault. It's just everyone's so wrong. Yes, tell me more.
I just have more things to say.
Hear,
jump on.
And I can't...
Use the words that God taught you. Or someone. Or something. Any
okay,
day.
Okay. Here's a great quote from Act 2, Scene 4.
It's from me.
The Dauphin says it.
The Dauphin?
But he says, self-love, my liege, is not so vile a sin as self-neglecting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure I need that inscribed above my bed. Okay, Act 3, Scene 1, we have a very well-known quote, once more.
Yeah, that's a whole famous speech.
That's right.
I know,
mm-hmm.
But that's the most famous part of it, I think. Because that was the main part where I was like, oh, snap.
It's happening.
I've heard this before.
I've been there.
I just want to talk about then, because it pretty much brings us to Act 3, Scene 2. I'm kind of going in order of the way I took my notes.
That's fine.
Uh-huh.
Which is this my favorite scene with the boy.
Oh, that
just,
page.
He's just like, these guys are no good.
What are you talking about?
And
we're fantastic role models.
I don't think you're good role models.
Are you kidding me?
Two of your friends get hanged a second later.
You know,
one of them only got hanged because he's a hero.
What?
That's right.
A hero. Tell us.
Wrongly accused. Poor Nim, fighting like a lion on the battlefield, finds a sword gilded with rubies, and with it slices 8 Frenchmen on the field. That's right. To his downfall, that fair sword belonged to an English noble who had lost it on battle. That's right. And they accused him of theft, and they hung him by the neck. That's right.
That's no good.
Right. Fair enough.
Thank you. Sign of the cross.
Yeah, that's true. You know who I just realized the little page boy reminds me of?
The little boys in Richard III?
No. The little page guy in Game of Thrones that Tyrion sends over to the horse.
Pod.
Pod. Pod. He's such a pod.
You're right.
And it's like Pod has this... soliloquy where he's like, I don't want to play this Game of Thrones anymore. Everyone is dying. I need a new life.
Yeah.
I'm gonna just pull a whatever that other guy's name is and just get in a boat and start rowing for 7 seasons. The bastard son of the bastard Baratheon.
Oh, yeah.
Who got in a boat and started rowing away at the end of one season and we've never seen him since.
He's gotta come back.
He joined the Brotherhood.
Did he?
He did.
What season?
He joined the
Brotherhood Without Banners.
That's right.
Really?
Truly.
All right. Then we come to the scene only in French, which just threw me for a loop, but also made me go, cool, I get to skip 5 pages of this play.
Nice.
This play is so long, minus 5 pages.
Who needs French?
What's a tucket? It's in Act 3, Scene 5. It's in the stage direction.
Personal trumpet call.
Oh!
There we are, which is as good as gold!
So I want a tucket every time I walk into a room then.
I guess you do.
I do. I want my own tucket.
Yeah.
Give me a tucket. I want a chauffeur and a tucket. That's in my contract.
That's technically like when Kramer walks in. Like, that's a tucket.
That's true. Then I was also just thinking as I was reading it that this play would not be as good if you hadn't read the other ones because you miss out on so much of Henry's history
yes.
with Bardolph and with Pistol and...
Significance of Falstaff. Relationships.
Yeah.
Dear John Falstaff.
Yeah.
Fallen true king.
Like, you
could
make sense of it logically, but you would lose so much of the depth of it.
Basically, if you don't know the history and what happened before, you have a nice war reenactment and no personality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No 180 on character.
Yeah, exactly.
For our dear Hal.
Now, what do you think of King Henry now that he's king, your old dear friend Hal?
Officially, the greatest king that ever ruled. Man, a lion in armor. And a statesman. And if he were not a king, he would be a pope. Unofficially, the guy's a bastard. Let's be completely honest here. He betrayed all of his friends. He allowed his good friend Bardolph to be hung without zero complaint and encouraged it in happening. And after, our poor dear John Falstaff let him just wither away mm-hmm. after banishing him. He died mm-hmm. of a broken heart, you know. I was there, sort of. Not nearby, not exactly there, but oh, I heard about it.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, Shakespeare, he shows all sides of Henry.
He really does.
He has to be a king. At some point, men must put away childish things, as they say.
As they say.
And unfortunately, we were his toys.
Our Act 3, Scene 6, to me, I just wrote, enough serious politics, let's have some good horse and sex jokes.
Is that the French?
It's the French camp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think they wanted to show, like, the French being...
lewd.
Yeah, and, like... reprehensible.
Doesn't surprise me that French would confuse their horses for their women.
The Duke of York is not Richard III because he's too old. It's too many years in between. So is he Richard III's father?
Richard is actually the son of that York.
So he's grandfather?
No,
or
that
uncle?
Is, I believe that. Correct me if I'm wrong, what do I know of noble lineages but everything? Listen to Pistol. I believe that York is the father of that deplorable Richard of Gloucester.
Did you ever meet that Richard?
So this is the York.
I would never debase myself like that. I hung out with fairer people, like prostitutes and thieves.
So this is the York who dies in Henry VI.
Because
that's when we see
right.
his sons.
Right. Then the grandfather. That's what I meant to say. Sure, why not?
Right, so grandfather. Okay. Cool. At one point, this play put me in mind of Othello, gloves versus handkerchiefs, and just these random plot points. Yes, I'm right.
No.
I would agree.
Nodding.
I don't
Pistol's agree. Nodding.
I'm right
Pistol's
there with you.
Pistol's on me.
Pistol's on you?
That can be arranged. But the point of the matter being is that, I hear you, gloves on people, handkerchiefs on people. Like,
yeah.
There's a connection there.
No, yes.
Right. I'm just saying, Shakespeare has a thing of just being like, hey, here's a plot point. Why don't you put it on your hat so everyone can see it and
know about it?
That
was tradition back in the day.
Oh, yes, it was.
When you would fight for a lady, let us say, you would grab her glove and then you would pin it to your hat. Mm-hmm. And as you fought battles, it would be in her honor, in her memory. So whenever you had a duel to fight, yes, you would pin it on your hat. So if someone saw it, the man owner of said glove, you'd know to call them out, and they'd know to call you out. And there could be no doubt as to your identity if you were a man of true honor. Do you know how many gloves I have?
How many?
11.
Do you really have 11?
Yes! That many. I'm that good. I don't like to brag, but I like to be honest.
You sound real honest right now.
That's what honest Pistol, they say. Kind, gracious Pistol.
Shoots from the hip.
Sometimes even saintly Pistol.
Mm-hmm.
Doubtful.
That's for you to say and for me to know.
So, Pistol, in Act 5, what's up with the leeks? Nim has to eat leeks? They're poison?
They're not poison,
leeks
they're disgusting.
Leeks are delicious.
Pistol has to eat leeks.
You have to eat leeks.
I might have eaten. I never ate a leek. Yeah. Ever. I don't know who told you that.
Don't listen to him.
Don't listen to him.
Fluellen embarrassed Pistol.
No.
Someone explain to me the significance of the leeks.
Listen. Leeks aren't meant for people. They're meant for the Welsh. It just so happens that Fluellen happens to be that. All right, I was simply reminding the man that if he's going to exist, he might as well be eating his favorite and only meal, leeks. And it just so happens that even he must be sick of it because he offered it ever so kindly to me. And I did not eat that leek. All right,
you did.
I don't care who. No,
you took a big
old bite. I never ate it.
That's what the reports say. Yeah,
the reports are lying.
Pistol makes fun of Fluellen when he gets mad at him. He starts naming all this like mean Welsh.
The
stuff.
Man hung my man.
And when he didn't hang his friend.
Okay, that's fair.
And so Fluellen, back after the war, when everyone's back in their status quo,
right,
makes Pistol eat a leek from his cap to be like, you made fun of me, now you gotta eat your words.
I brought him some salt and water and said, here you go for your leek. And he didn't take too kindly to it. Let's just put it that way.
So it's like, I don't know, biting your thumb or something.
It's worse. It's like smooshing someone's face in the mud. As opposed to just challenging someone, it's like really making them do something bad.
Okay, I wasn't going to get too much into the St. Crispin's Day speech because I thought we were going to talk about it later, but apparently we're not. So, do you have anything that you want to say on it, though?
I had never read this, and when I... But I've watched the Hollow Crown when they have it. But
who does the speech in that?
Oh, who do you think?
Is it my fave?
No,
is it your fave?
It's my fave. Tom Hiddy.
Mm-hmm.
I got, so when I read it for the first time, which was this time, I got chills.
Yeah, it's a really powerful speech.
It was so exciting.
Who, okay. If you could pick anyone to do this speech for you, not Tom Hiddleston.
Patrick Stewart.
Oh, see, I was thinking Viggo Mortensen.
Oh,
what?
That's
a great one.
Have you not seen Lord of the Rings?
Dude? Yeah, what? Patrick Stewart, completely agree.
Yeah,
but no, Patrick Stewart would be great.
I mean,
also, David Tennant would be pretty awesome.
Eh.
No?
I like David Tennant's comedy stuff more than his dramatic stuff that I've seen Shakespeare.
Yeah, that's true.
Take a Suri and McKellen doing the speech as well.
Yeah, that wouldn't be bad.
Be pretty nice. Okay.
Okay.
Gender swap it.
Oh, no, wait.
Helen Mirren.
James Maggie.
In a heartbeat.
Yes!
Oh, that's a good
Lady Maggie Smith, or Dame Maggie Smith.
Yeah. What's her name? Fiona.
Fiona Shaw.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, she played Richard II, remember?
I would definitely pick that. Okay.
What about Amy Adams?
Tilda Swinton.
Classic Amy Adams.
Could Emily
Tilda
Blunt
Swinton, for sure.
Nice.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah, this speech is great. One thing that I've heard, God, who told me this? I heard this at Bada.
Yeah.
I think it was Fiona Shaw, because I think that was when we were doing it in front of everyone. So it starts out, I mean, him just trying to talk to his officers, and like, in the end, he ends up being like, all of us are going to be brothers by the end of this. So
yes, We Band of Brothers also comes from this too,
right?
Right,
and saying that too.
And is it We Few, We Happy Few is also in this?
Yeah.
There's, I'm telling you, listeners, pull to the side of the road, whatever you got to do, read this whole speech right now, or let's find a good YouTube clip of somebody doing it.
Yeah.
Post it on the wall.
But what's important about that is that it is about telling the poor that are fighting with them.
Yeah.
Like, today, you're nobles. You stay here and stick with us in this battle, we're probably going to lose. I mean, he's trying to just say, like, we're not going to lose it.
Yeah.
But the odds are against us. If you stick with us, like, you are the same as me. And when we saw this being worked at Bada, the Shakespeare thing I did, she was like, start on stage and then come off stage and like get on the ground with the like commoners.
Yes.
I was like, oh, that's so good.
Oh, it's so good. Now, Pistol, you didn't like his first speech earlier in the play. How did
I
you
never
feel
said
about
I
this
didn't
one?
Like him. Who says? I just didn't admit that I participated.
Was this speech better?
You know what? There was a dash of uplifting ness to it, I will say that, yes.
I thought you were going to say there was a dash of salt water on my face. From my tears.
From my tears? Never! Pistol doesn't cry. If there's salt water here, it's from everyone else weeping by him.
Or leaks.
Or never leaks. The point of the matter being is, yes, stirring speech. I will say, it's been a long time since I felt anything true from Al, and that was one of those few and remaining moments. leads.
Mm. Well, I think
it's nice having a leader.
It was life or death, for sure.
That's right.
That's what he knew.
That's what we all knew. When you're 5-1, you're pretty much done.
Okay, so in sort of pretty much the last scene when Henry is wooing Catherine, is he a major player making himself look foolish and being like, oh, you make me so nervous, I don't even know what to say. Or is he really think that? Or
that
is it a character choice?
I think
director.
Yeah, it's like an actor choice for sure. I think mostly it's a play, because also like to be like lower than themselves.
Okay, so he's flirting. He knows what he's doing.
There's a couple of ways to take it though, because he could be flirting just to flirt. He could be trying to make her comfortable, or he could be messing with her like maliciously.
Yeah. I know he's flirting, but I think that's my point. Like, is he flirting with her and trying to make her comfortable, or is he It's not clear. And I think I had a similar question of this in the last Henry play that we were reading. So,
when he steals the crown from his dad, who's asleep, I agree.
I think Henry, to me, is a more fascinating character that I would want to delve deeper into than Hamlet. I said it. I think what I like about a lot of Henry's speeches and Henry's scenes is that they seem really clear on the surface, but you could so easily take it another way.
Yeah.
And I would really, if I had to pick a male role, I think, in any Shakespeare play to work on and play with, I think it would be Hal.
In that scene, I would say, in my opinion, I think he's earnestly trying to win her over. And the reasoning is one of the last things he says in the moment before, as his, as the king of France walks out, he says, chief among all my demands is your daughter.
Right.
So clearly he has shown an interest so high that no matter what they agree on, he wants marriage to be at the top of that list.
But is it marriage or is
it
heirs?
It is marriage.
Is it heirs that he wants?
No,
Well, you always want heirs.
No, I think he wants the politics of it.
But here's the thing. He rejected her before.
Right. With a lower dowry.
At heart's floor. That's right. It was not sufficient.
So I think we're arguing the same thing.
Slightly different. I'm saying he still wants the woman. He wants the woman regardless of the land. He wants better land, yes.
But at the same time, he denied her before.
That's right. He denied her before. Now, it's not enough to basically get what you want, but then get screwed over in this other category. He wants to win it both. Mm-hmm. But he won't take a lesser bride either. Mm-hmm. He says no matter what you agree on, in terms of the land, I still want this woman. And keep in mind, this is the first time he has ever seen her in person. So maybe he finally saw her with his own eyes and said, dear Lord Almighty, there's a deal.
And then we come to the second half of that scene where he forces her to kiss him.
Yes, that is a little weird.
See?
Yeah.
Hey, listen, the charm of the 15th century man is lost on no one.
I think it's an interesting metaphor, though, because this play is built upon, can we rule France with English law? Like, that's pretty much the thesis at the beginning of this play. Mm. And then having this, like, social thing that mirrors that at the end, being like, can we rule France with English custom? And forcing it. It's very interesting. I mean, this whole play is the development of Henry's final chapter of, like, becoming king and what kind of king he's going to be.
Right.
And setting all that up, because apparently the epilogue is about, it basically says, like, but as we all know, English citizens, Henry V dies pretty young, and then Henry VI, the boy king, like, this little kid has to become king and has a really messed up situation.
Yeah.
Which we've already been through.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of my last note that I had made. I mean, I have one other thing, but I'll bring it up later on, is just the final chorus. I think the cliff notes of the final chorus might be, don't get too happy, guys, it goes south from here.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect setup for the next one.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is he wrote those first, so everybody had already seen them all.
So we're reading them almost in published
order.
Kind of, yeah.
I just knew that I wanted to save these, because I like them.
Yeah.
And I didn't think I was going to like this.
Watching episode 4, 5, and 6.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And knowing that someone turns into Vader.
Own heart.
Yeah, you know someone turns into Vader.
Yeah. I feel feel like this is one of the first plays. We've seen chorus at the beginning and at the very end of the play, but not introducing, like, every single act.
Right.
Modern update, quote-unquote, World War II, and have the chorus be propaganda films.
I like that. I get into that. I wanted to talk a little bit about choruses today, because I looked it up, and I think the only other one with a chorus is Romeo and Juliet, which is tale of such woe as Juliet and her Romeo has a prologue and an epilogue. Can you think of another chorus?
Yes. I mean, I can't think. I mean, Winter's Tale has time.
Right.
We have other things that act as
but
chorus.
It's different.
Okay, so then what then is the difference between something being a chorus and something just being like breaking the fourth wall?
I wish you looked in my
eyes.
Hope
you liked our show.
Because you would have seen stars in them. Glad you asked. It all stems from Greek tragedy and comedy choruses.
Okay, yeah.
And the research of that is before you actually had, like, plays and stuff, it was just choruses talking about events in song and dance
right.
and all this stuff. And then this one guy, Thespis,
yeah.
stepped out onto stage and did a speech as a character. And that's supposedly, like, the first actor.
Yes.
And then they had actors and choruses. And the difference is the actor is pretending to be a character, and the chorus is commenting and acts as the worldview of that character in the time of that play or of the playwright or of the audience itself. So they're passive, and they just talk about what's going on.
So
the actor is active.
So then is a character like the stage manager in our town a character or a chorus, or is that a director's choice?
Well, the thing is, chorus eventually turned into a function.
Right.
Right? Not so much
right.
a character in
mm-hmm.
itself. It's just developed
right.
into a part of the play. So you can
right.
have characters function as the chorus. Mm-hmm. So a stage manager can be both the character and the function of a chorus.
So
and
since
I,
this one is called the chorus,
it has no character.
He's just relaying, or it is just relaying information.
It's
and
an
it would be a single.
Party.
Would it be a single person, or would it be like a Greek chorus that's usually three or more?
In the original times, I'm sure it was a single person because their troops were so small.
Okay.
Nowadays, you can do whatever you want, but
okay.
what it basically acts as the thing to remember that I think is important is that a chorus is opinion; it's not fact. You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's a perspective. And in this play, I think it's used to show, like, the thoughts of Henry sort of from, like, present day and sort of from the people of the time of Henry V to say, like, oh, Henry's such a great king, and then see him do all this stuff. So the first chorus talks about, like, warful Henry, but then the first act is just him talking around going to war and
right.
figuring out if it's actually the right thing to do
right.
and whether if he deserved the throne or not. So he's very not confident, warlike Mars person Henry.
It also functions to basically just relay simple exposition. What's
right.
happening in the world? Where are we going?
Right.
Imagine, if you will, the sails picking
yeah.
up. Now we're journeying across
yeah.
the English Channel.
And then the third function
uh-huh.
is it's kind of a hype man for this play. It's like the person who comes out and makes the audience clap, but for Jimmy Fallon, it's
right,
like that.
Right.
To be like, you guys, you're this. I wish we could do this battle better justice, because it is crazy right now. This is happening, this is happening, and then here comes Henry, and then he enters.
So then the character of Time in Winter's Tale functions as a chorus, but is a character. So isn't that still that character's opinion, though? Or are characters giving facts?
Well, since Time is more like a god,
okay,
he doesn't have an opinion.
Man, you
on
would not
man.
Believe that I have a degree in theater history. I guess that's my point. Is it?
Does the chorus have a perspective? Is that what you're asking?
No, I think I'm just going off into another realm.
Theory?
Not theory, just another realm of. It's more of an artistic or creative question or decision per production of.
Yeah,
you know, and I'll get into this more when we talk about Pericles, but we did Pericles when I was in college, and the director, it was her graduate production, and she semi-created the character Diana, the goddess Diana, who was in every scene and, you know, would move the set by waving her arms or whatever, and was seen as this goddess force in Pericles' life and constantly watching over. She only has a few lines or maybe no lines, I can't remember, but she was always on stage. And so that's the creative decision of, while this is a chorus and right. kind of just serving as a plot point, I'm making it a character and I'm making it active within the story.
Right.
So I think that's, and that's probably where my confusion comes in saying, wait, we haven't read anything else with a chorus, because we've definitely read other plays where there are people functioning as a chorus or functioning as, this is the exposition and time is passing. It's the end of one of the Henrys, and somebody's like, hold on though, don't be, it's not this one.
I think
like,
that's Richard III at the end of Henry the Sixth Part Three. So we're talking about where he's holding the baby and he's
yes.
like, but one day I'm going to kill you. But
yes.
The difference is,
yes.
he's not saying, and in the future, I'm going to kill you and become king, but then I'll lose my kingdom. He's not an omnipotent thing. He's saying,
right.
but I bet I'll do this.
So then why are you saying that the chorus is not factual, the chorus is opinionated? I feel
because
like the character is opinionated versus...
Maybe, what
factual.
She means is perspective. There's a specific perspective.
What I'm saying is
okay.
that you can't take it as fact. So, like, if they're listing history events or descriptions of stuff,
uh-huh.
that makes sense. But if they're listing stuff about the king... And then right after that, we see sort of evidence that's
it's an untrustworthy narrator?
I don't know. I don't know what to tell you.
This conversation, more than anything else, has made me want to direct Shakespeare. And I don't ever want to direct anything, but there's so... I could have a dialogue on this for a really long time, so we can move on.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating.
Keep in mind that when these things were written, they had to be in line with respect
right.
to the ruling class, right? You can't speak
okay.
out against it.
Hello, I am news reporter from the battlefield, and here's what's going down.
With a little bit of a pro-English flourish. Keep in mind, even when the bad guys lose here,
Fox News for
each one of them, is grateful for losing to such a fantastic enemy. You know what? I'm glad I got caught. Punish me, kill me, but forgive me, my dear king, for that is my true sin. It's all written to basically show that the nobility is always in the right, is essentially infallible.
Are there any modern-day adaptations outside of The Hollow Crown, which isn't modern-day but a current
yeah,
film
everything
version?
Is pretty much just a film version of it. I've heard
yeah.
this is the best Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare. I've never seen
movie?
It.
Movie?
Yeah.
I'm so down to
yeah,
watch.
Yeah, we gotta watch that.
Down.
And then there's an old-timey...
There's a Laurence Olivier version?
There's a Laurence Olivier version as well, which
that's
I've also
cool.
never seen. But
he also does a fantastic Richard III.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Fantastic.
This play's thick. You want to read a scene?
Let's do it.
So we're going to read a little bit of Act 2, Scene 1, where we see Bardolph and Pistol arguing, and it's the first time we see all of Hal's old companions.
Here comes ancient Pistol and his wife. Good corporal, be patient here. How now, mine host, Pistol?
Base type calls me a host. Now, by this hand, I swear I scorn the term, nor shall my Nell keep lodgers.
No, by my troth, not long, for we cannot lodge and board a dozen or 14 gentlewomen that live honestly by the prick of their needles, but it will be thought we keep a body house straight. Oh, well, dear lady, if he be not drawn now, we shall see willful adultery and murder committed. Good lieutenant, good corporal, offer nothing here.
Fish!
Pish for thee, Iceland dog, thou prick-eared cur of Iceland.
Good corporal nymph, show thy valor and put up your sword.
Will you shog off? I would have you solus.
Solus? Egregious dog? A viper vile. The solus in thy most marvelous face, the solus in thy teeth and in thy throat and in thy hateful lungs, yea, in thy maw, purdy end, which is worse, within thy nasty mouth. I do retort the solace in thy bowels, for I can take, and Pistol's cock is up, and flashing fire will follow.
I am not Barbasan. You cannot conjure me. I have an humor to knock you indifferently well. If you grow foul with me, Pistol, I'll scour you with my rapier, as I may, in fair terms. If you would walk off, I would prick your guts a little in good terms, as I may, and that's the humor.
Oh, braggart vile, and damned furious wight. The grave doth gape, and doting death is near, therefore exhale.
Hear me what I say. He that strikes the first stroke, I'll run him up to the hilt as I am a soldier.
An oath of mickle might, and fury shall abate. Give me thy fist, thy forefoot to me give. Thy spirits are most tall.
We'll cut thy my throat one time or other in fair terms. That is the humor of it.
Kuplea gorge is the word. I defy thee again, O hound of Crete. Think'st thou my spouse to get? No, to the spittle go. And from the powdering tub of infamy fetch forth the laser kite of Cressid's kind. Dull Tearsheet she by name, and her a spouse. I have, and I will hold, the quondam quickly, for only she and Pauca. There's enough to go to.
Love it.
Yay! Thanks so much for coming.
Yes.
My pleasure.
Nice to have you, Pistol.
So nice to meet you. Thanks for listening, guys. I'm Allison.
I'm Beverly.
Deuces, peasants! That's right. Why, hello there and good morrow, whatever. Oh, you just poured coffee all over yourself. She's very impressed and broke the chair.
I was betrayed.
If I can just say, I didn't know it was that charming.